The North Sound Energy Week with Stork Technical Services, delivering asset integrity solutions to the global energy industry.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Rebecca Curran. This week, there was a dramatic helicopter ditching in the North Sea after a Super Puma experienced a loss in oil pressure 30 miles east of Aberdeen. All 14 men were returned to shore safely and escaped serious injury, but it's raised questions over safety. A report has revealed Scotland's oil and gas sector remains upbeat despite continuing concerns over the Chancellor's shock windfall tax last year. And do we finally have an end to the threat of a fuel tanker driver's strike? On Thursday, we reported a helicopter had ditched in the North Sea shortly after 12 o'clock at lunchtime. All 14 men were returned safely to Aberdeen and escaped serious injury. The aircraft involved was a Bond Super Puma Eurocopter, the same model which ditched in 2009 with 18 men on board, and the same model which crashed just 6 weeks later, killing all 16 passengers and crew. Ashley Roy from the Bond Aviation Group spoke to reporters in Aberdeen about the incident on Thursday. Bond grounded their fleet later that night, but unions are expressing their concern. Unite claim there have been problems with engines recently, which haven't been reported to the helicopter steering group. Here's regional organiser John Taylor.
Well, there's been a number of engine problems. These were never reported to us, nor were they reported to the workforce. After the helicopter task force was set up, an agreement was put in place that incidents like this would be reported. We are so concerned that we've asked for an emergency meeting of the helicopter group, which is going to be meeting early next week. It's agreed that any problems with any helicopter would be reported to the safety committee on the platform and to the general workforce. This would allow the task group, if necessary, to set up an investigation and examine the root problems to these incidents. Because this hasn't happened, we've not been able to carry out that function. It's beyond me. They talked about openness and frankness and gaining the confidence of the workforce. This has lost the confidence of the workforce. We've already had some phone calls with some of our members being concerned about flying offshore with this helicopter company. I believe that the meeting is going to be called early next week.
The steering group is due to meet on Monday. Retired pilot Michael Buckley from Inverurie has almost three decades' experience flying Eurocopter Super Pumas. He spoke to Energy Week about the difficulty of ditching a helicopter.
Ditching, it's not they don't practice in the simulator. It's very difficult to simulate a ditching in water on a simulator. So they can do all sorts of other things on land. But ditching in the water is not something these guys would have practiced, so it's a one-off for them. It's the first time, and hopefully for them it'll be the last time. Because they've still got the engine power, they can actually take the aircraft down to very low over the water. They would have inflated the emergency flotation equipment around about 100 feet as they were descending. They would have warned all the passengers what's going to happen, briefed them already. The problem getting the aircraft into the water is to land. If you can imagine that the sea as a like a sine wave, where you've got the peaks and the troughs, it's how deep those troughs are and how close together the peaks are, the wavelength, causes the problem. If they're fairly close together, then the trough appears deeper, the steepness of the wave, if you like, is increased. The further apart the crests are, the easier it is to get the aircraft down. The idea is to try to land it into the trough at an angle. The other problem is that you try to land the helicopter into wind. Unfortunately, the waves tend to go at 90 degrees to the wind. And what you don't want to do is to push the front of it, the nose of the helicopter with the nose flotation bag, into the front of a wave, because it could possibly burst the bag and the aircraft wouldn't float very well. So the idea is to try to turn it slightly out of wind and land into the trough with as minimum forward speed as possible so you don't damage any of the flotation bags. At that point, they would make sure that the emergency transmitter, the location transmitter, which is fitted on the rear of the aircraft, that should automatically deploy in contact with salt water. But one of the drills is to make sure it has deployed manually. There's a manual way of deploying it, but you would make sure it's gone. Shut the engines down to stop the rotor turning overhead. And provided the aircraft is then fully stable in the water, it's not rocking about too much, both the pilots would go through the into the cabin, open the main doors, and then deploy the life rafts. Now, I understand they were all in one life raft. There are two life rafts fitted, one on each side of the aircraft, on the front of the sponsons. And each life raft has a 14-seat capacity with an overcapacity of 50%. So you can get all 21 people, 19 passengers and two crew, into one life raft if necessary. But I believe there was only 14 on the aircraft this time, so it was quite easy to get everybody into the single dinghy. And basically, make sure you get everybody in, pull the covers up over the dinghy and wait for rescue.
Earlier in the week, a report was published claiming Scotland's oil and gas sector remains upbeat, despite continuing concerns over the Chancellor's shock windfall tax last year. The latest survey by Aberdeen and Grampian Chamber of Commerce says there's a lingering impact over George Osborne's budget blow. At the time, the industry warned it could put jobs and billions of pounds of investment at risk. Paul Stockley from Bond Piers says fiscal policy isn't the only concern for the sector.
It's showing, I think, cause for greater optimism than we had this time last year. It's the results came or straddled the last budget. But even before that, I think it was looking like a better picture. After that, once the budget gives a mixed impression, I suppose. We feel there's more optimism coming out of it, and we're certainly seeing that in our business. Having said that, and as I explained at the press conference, there are issues around the fiscal stability in the North Sea, issues around skills shortages, issues around the infrastructure within the city, and issues around regulation, particularly the EU's attempts and campaign to impose blanket safety regulation on the EU.
I think if we touch first on the fiscal stuff, obviously the Chancellor's shock budget last year, I think Paul made quite an interesting point about, you know, they were expecting, I think it was 11 million, they wanted 13 and they ended up getting 9. What does that tell us? Quite interesting figures.
Yeah, I guess it tells us that commercially, these things are a fight to get. But I think the fact that they got anything out of this budget and to get some more positive signals is certainly a reinforcement and an endorsement of the campaign that was led by Oil and Gas UK.
Now, I think one of the things you spoke quite a lot about was the EU regulation and the potential of taking over safety policy. I mean, you said that it would be like setting a ticking time bomb. I mean, elaborate on that a bit.
Well, I think it's the fact that the North Sea, post the Piper Alpha incident, really addressed safety in the UK. And it became very much a question of risk assessment and then managing those risks, and moved away from having a prescriptive regime to a more commercially based risk assessment regime. And I think if we had a situation where you had the European Union imposing additional bureaucracy and blanket regulation on an industry which already sets the bar on in the North Sea, could potentially be a very dangerous mistake.
I mean, how did the album come at the worst possible time, given that it could add impetus to their argument that they want to take over safety?
I think it is, it's without a doubt, it's unfortunate timing, because perhaps the impetus was beginning to move away from that, and the impetus probably has been thrown back now. But having said that, the way in which the incident was managed and going forward, I think is a reinforcement of the regime we have in place.
And you spoke a lot about skill shortages as well. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, well, we see that in our business, in professional services, where we are continually recruiting people from a graduate perspective quite easily, training them up, and then losing them within the pool of the operators or the contractors or other law firms. And I think that's just being typified across the whole industry. I worked for 6 years in Hess before joining Bond Pierce, and that was my experience, that you just saw people popping up in and about different oil companies, and it's a fairly small community in reality, and you see the same people coming around in this swirling pool of labour, as I put it. And I think it does have a really negative effect on corporate memory in particular.
What do you think, what do you suggest you should have done about that?
I think it needs more collaboration between all parts of the industry, from operators to contractors to the professional services organisations, to really invest in training and to really invest in bringing people through and then sustaining that skills and that experience so that we don't have that loss of corporate memory within organisations.
And just finally, I think the other constraint that kind of pricked up my ears was the Aberdeen infrastructure, you know, and the sort of lack of, especially concerning the airport. I mean, how much of a danger is that for future and for making Aberdeen the energy hub of, you know?
I think I have probably less familiarity as an Englishman with the Aberdeen market, but I think it is an issue because we see that Aberdeen certainly has its infrastructure issues. I've been coming here for years, since my Hess days, the late 90s, and had experience of driving up to Alton's and it taking forever in a taxi. So I have experience on that side, but we see the opportunity for Aberdeen to be just not just the oil capital, but to really benefit from the renewables business once it begins to thrive, as I'm sure it will here. But also, as the North Sea declines, which is no time soon because there's 24 billion barrels to be discovered, but as the oil industry does decline here, unless Aberdeen has reinvented itself to take advantage of international markets, it could be a real issue, I think.
Bob Collier is from Aberdeen and Grampian Chamber of Commerce. He spoke to Energy Week about the survey.
The industry is certainly picking up a little bit after the hit it took from the budget last year. There's a lot of information there that investment levels are starting to rise. There's also evidence about some of the constraints that might stop that growth as well. Generally, a better performance in exports than locally in the UKCS. If you look at the numbers, you can see that the industry was pretty much on to deliver around about 11 billion to the Treasury in the last 12 months or so. I think the government got greedy and the government wanted 13 billion, which is why it put the tax up to get that extra 2 billion to pay for fuel rises. What it's actually ended up getting is closer to 9 billion. So it got 4 billion less than it wanted and 2 billion less than it would have done. That looks like smart decision making to me.
But, I mean, as you said, you know, things are improving from that massive shock delivered by Chancellor.
Yeah, I think you've got to remember this is an industry which operates globally, operates in all sorts of markets which are high risk, and it's dealing with shocks and dealing with issues all the time. What it thought was the UKCS was a relatively stable area where it could do business. It was a banker. And the more tax changes you get, the more uncertainties you get, the more it puts it onto a par with other areas that have got greater risk. And that's a threat. And we've got to make sure that government understands that it won't keep the expertise and the know-how here, which we can use to export, if it messes about with the industry.
How concerned are you over a move towards EU regulations?
Well, the first important result was making sure that those regulations were being considered at the right committee, and that decision was made a week or so ago. It'll be on the committee that deals with energy and business rather than the one that deals with the environment. You've got to ask whether an EU of 27 countries, where only four of them have got an offshore industry, whether they are competent to regulate for this. And you've got to ask whether a box-ticking approach, which is the common approach in the rest of the world, is better than the one we've got in the North Sea, which is risk-based and proven and world leader. So everybody's concerned to lose that best-in-class health and safety process for one that is inferior, and quite rightly.
For the first time you asked a question about Scottish independence, tell us a little bit, elaborate on that.
Well, I think all we can say from the first question, and by the way, we've asked this, it'll be asked four times again before we actually get to autumn 2014, is to get a baseline. And that baseline says, yes, there is some uncertainty. There's uncertainty, but what can you say? People say there's uncertainty. It also says that a significant number of businesses are used to managing uncertainty, and they'll deal with whatever comes out of it. But so long as uncertainty is there as to where energy policy sits, is it at Westminster? Is it Holyrood? Is it in Europe? Then we'll be recording those figures. But too soon to tell, perhaps.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it kind of pans out, how the trends. Yeah. And just finally, I mean, how important do you think that, you know, obviously the Cliff, I think, more prominently mentioned, you know, that Aberdeen's infrastructure. Mm. I mean, how important do you think it is to improve our airports to get the AWPR up and running?
Well, you'll see that the growth in export business is significantly higher than the growth in UKCS. That means more and more of Aberdeen PLC's business is overseas. That means we've got to be able to get to that business, which means connectivity. It also means we've got to attract international talent here. So we've got to compete more effectively as a global city, and we've got to connect to other global cities in that sector more efficiently. Otherwise, we risk losing that expertise to other places. And who would do that to such a golden goose?
On Tuesday, a trade mission from the Falkland Islands touched down in Aberdeen to learn more about the oil and gas industry. During the three-day visit, the team of 30 heard from experts from both city and shire councils and also Oil and Gas UK. John Woodward is from the Chamber of Commerce who organised the visit.
Their economy today is largely based on fishing. And, of course, the introduction of oil will very much diversify that economy and could very substantially change it in its own right. So these are very important meetings that they're going to have this week to understand how Aberdeen and its region actually manage the introduction of oil into society and into the economy.
On Wednesday, UK companies in the oil and gas well services industry reported a 2% rise in revenue to almost $3 billion. Oil and Gas UK's report on the sector found the number of highly skilled jobs supported by these companies rose by 10% last year. This included 2,000 graduate engineers and 1,500 technicians. David Ridley from Oil and Gas UK spoke to Energy Week.
Well, the figures that you're talking about refer to the figures that come out of the Well Service Contractors Association report, which is a report we do annually, and it's specific to one subsector of the oil and gas industry, namely the well services sector. And it's to some extent a mirror of the industry in general. The figures are showing that year on year, or since last year, they have shown an increase of 28% in revenues generated approaching $3 billion. Also through the same period, there's been an increase in highly skilled jobs in the sector, a 10% increase in headcount, taking the people employed within the well services division to about 13,000. And that's predominantly graduates and skilled technicians. So it's been a very healthy year for the well services sector for two reasons. One, there's been quite a high level of domestic activity based on the wave of spending over the last couple of years generated by some major projects. Going back to 2010, that would include things like Jasmine and Lagan Tomor, and more recently Clare Ridge, Golden Eagle, Canoe. So there's a reasonably high level of projects in the UK. But more and more, it's also been fueled by international growth. Many of the companies, although anchored or headquartered in the UK, in Scotland and Aberdeen, are now actually progressively increasing their export revenues. So it's been fueled from two sources.
On Friday, we heard preparations for a well kill at the stricken Elgin platform are in the final stages. Total are hoping to pump mud under the seabed in a matter of days. Gas has been leaking from the installation since the end of March, but the amount being released has fallen significantly. A team which dealt with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill will be in charge of the operation. If it doesn't work, there's a relief well currently being drilled as a backup, but that will take months to finish. The owner of British Gas warned at the end of the week that household gas bills are likely to rise again this year. Centrica says there's been a 15% increase in wholesale prices, which will typically add around £50 to the cost of supplying a home. Earlier this year, the company reported flat profits following what it described as a tough 2011. And some good news to end the week. A strike by fuel tanker drivers has been narrowly avoided after a deal was reached over terms and conditions. It follows fuel shortages and panic buying at forecourts earlier this year. Unite said its members backed the deal by 51%. And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Rebecca Kern.
The North Sound Energy Week with Stark Technical Services, delivering asset integrity solutions to the global energy industry.